The pursuit of pleasure seems to preoccupy our thoughts, consume our longings, and inspire our passions. This is the human condition. And no one described this endless pursuit of pleasure more eloquently than Solomon. His personal journal, the Book of Ecclesiastes, chronicles the quest of a middle-aged man looking for purpose and meaning. Today on Insight for Living, you'll hear Chuck Swindoll continue our series called Living on the Ragged Edge. It's based on Solomon's writings and what Chuck refers to as the Confessions of a Cynic. Before we hear Chuck's sermon, we'll begin by reading from Ecclesiastes chapter 2.
Solomon held the highest office in the nation. He was the king of the land. His nation had enjoyed peace and prosperity. In fact, his very name meant peace. Shalom, peace. And in a nation that had enjoyed decades of peace, there was, sort of a yawning, aching desire to lie back, relax, and enjoy life for a while. This king was looking under the heavens to find happiness without God. Remember that. Trying to find happiness without God. In the first chapter of Solomon's journal, we saw that he had tried educational stimulation and a measure of scientific exploration. Both had left him empty. So he decided to pursue another course, to scratch some itches that had been there all his life, deep down in the sensual pleasures of life. Listen closely as I read today from Solomon's journal, the Book of Ecclesiastes, regarding these pleasures. These words are found in the New Living Translation Study Bible. I'm reading chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. I said to myself, "Come on, let's try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life." But I found that this too was meaningless. So I said, "Laughter is silly. What good does it do to seek pleasure?" After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. And while still seeking wisdom, I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I tried to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born into my household. I also owned large herds and flocks, more than any of the kings who had lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could desire. So I became greater than all who had lived in Jerusalem before me, and my wisdom never failed me. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere.
You're listening to Insight for Living, and you can access resources to complement our study in Ecclesiastes by going online to insightworld.org. And now the message from Chuck Swindoll titled, "Eat, Drink, and be what?"
Six single-syllable words comprise the motto of this generation. Perhaps it's too limited to say it's just this generation, but perhaps it would be better to say the last several generations. Now, these words are not in a brash and bold manner dangled in front of our eyes for everyone to read. They are much more subtle, subliminal than that. They are heard on campuses where we learn. They are heard in neighborhoods where we live, in the office where we work, and they are heard in the films and the plays that we attend. Those who write these words write them in indelible ink, but it's strangely invisible, so that you're not actually able to see the words, you're only able to feel the impact of what those words are saying. People who write our music write them in the pop songs of our day. People who put our books together and give us words to read and design much of our clothing and produce our magazines and even lodge us when we travel understand those words, and they massage those words as they put them into the text of life. The words are often spoken, but we really are a bit immune to what they really say. These are the words: if it feels good, do it. I suppose they come out in various ways, on bumper stickers and license frames and t-shirt messages, or little signs like the one I saw in a sophisticated boutique store that appeals to the sophisticated buyer. The little sign read, "He who dies with the most toys wins." They appear in commercials, they appear in the slogans. The ad man knows them well, and he uses them because those words scratch itches down inside us. But they are not new. We've just sort of perfected them. They go back as ancient as the days in which Eros became the familiar word among the ancient Greeks. They are as old as the Epicurean philosophy that says, eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow you're going to die, and since we die like dogs and are dumped in the earth never to live again, you might as well get all you can while you're going around this one time. Other men of other generations have been concerned, as we are, John Steinbeck, among many others. Steinbeck wrote a letter to Adlai Stevenson, presidential hopeful at the time, and Steinbeck wrote, "There is a creeping, all-pervading gas of immorality which starts in the nursery and does not stop until it reaches the highest offices, both corporate and governmental." It is a world of feeling, this world of ours. Sensual comes from the words sense or senses. And it would have to do not with everything that is innately evil, but it has the ability to become that. The senses would be that which we can taste and smell and see and hear and touch. The things that give us the creature comforts, the bodily cravings, the good as well as the evil, though each one of the senses is not in itself wrong. God gave us the senses. But if pushed to a far enough extreme, we move into either heresy or perversion. There is a place where if it feels good, do it, breaks down. And that brings us to this second chapter of Ecclesiastes. What a book this is. What a book. It is written by a man who had the highest office in the nation. He was a king. He had peace. His very name means peace. And in a nation that has four decades of peace on the heels of four decades of war under David's leadership, there is sort of a yawning, aching desire to enjoy life for a while. And the king, for whatever reason, decides he has worked long enough and hard enough, and it's time to satisfy some of these senses. For after all, he's trying to find happiness. Remember, the theme of the book is under the sun or under heaven. You've marked those several times already in chapter 1. They appear again in verse 3 of chapter 2. And verse 11 closes with the same words. In other words, this king is looking under the heavens to find happiness without God. He's tried a little bit of education and a little bit of intellect in chapter 1, and it left him dry and hanging. And so he's decided to pursue another course to scratch some of those itches that have been there all of his life. So he talks to himself. Verse 1, I said to myself. I thought it interesting when I first read chapter 2, verse 1 of Ecclesiastes, that the man is talking to himself. He doesn't tap on the shoulder of a counselor and say, my friend, come here, you're older than I, talk to me about what this might mean. So he doesn't seek the counsel of another wiser than he or more experienced than he. He doesn't delve into history and read the record of his own father who could have saved him from many a heartache. For David, though dead, still spoke. He doesn't even look up and ask God for counsel. He's talking to himself. In fact, literally it reads, I said in my heart. You and I do that when we muse. We say things to ourselves at times. I get a little troubled when I tell myself things I hadn't heard before, to be honest with you. But I do at times talk to myself, and I do rattle around in my head a number of things that I don't traffic in, but they're there nevertheless. Solomon is doing that. In his heart, he's musing. One man has paraphrased it, I resolved. I think that a little bit strong. It's only a fantasy right now, but he's decided to move it into reality. And so he says, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So in talking to himself, Solomon says, inviting himself, come along. Get on board. Let's get in the mainstream of where this sensual life is, and let's see what it's all about. He calls it pleasure. And by the way, Hugh Hefner has no original mark on the subject of pleasure and eroticism. It is nothing more than an old song in a new dress that comes out in the Playboy philosophy of our day. The hedonism of our times is as old as Solomon and even older than that. Solomon decides he will pursue that. And so he says in verse 1 what the waitress says when she serves you that delicious meal, enjoy. I said to myself, I will pursue pleasure. And then I answer to myself, enjoy. Have at it. But he, some would say, takes all the fun out of it by telling us it was empty to begin with. Verse 1. Behold, lo and behold, it was empty. One of the more reliable Hebrew scholars named Leupold, H.C. Leupold, writes something about this Hebrew style. I was intrigued with the fact that before we ever even trafficked in it, he told us it wasn't worth it, and I wondered why. It is a style of writing that is frequently employed by Hebrew authors, that even before a matter is given in a more detailed description, the outcome of it all is indicated. Now, that's not like the American writer. That's the Hebrew writer. Those who write our pornography would not tell us this on the front end. There isn't a front piece that appears before the X-rated film is shown telling you it is empty, it is futile, it is dissatisfying, it is lacking in fulfillment. They'll leave that for you to discover on your own. This Hebrew writer says to begin with, it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Before I go further, I want to address the times in which we live as far as the appeal to our sex drive is concerned. We don't address that often from this pulpit, but I think in light of the passage we're into and the pleasure of it all, though it certainly, as we shall see, isn't limited to the sexual side of life, I think some things need to be said. We have never lived in a more satiated time, nor would our forefathers believe it if they were suddenly dropped on the scene of today. I'll not harass about this or harangue, but I do ask for a few moments of your time here. We are rearing our children in a decadent era. If you're not aware of that, moms and dads, you're really blind and sightless. It is an awful time in which to survive. But it isn't, for that matter, new. Prophets of yesteryear warned us of such times. Peter and Sorokin, Sorokin, at one time professor of sociology at Harvard University, wrote a book back in the mid-1950s entitled The American Sex Revolution. And even then he wrote, "The sex drive is now declared to be the most vital mainspring of human behavior. In the name of science, its fullest satisfaction is urged as a necessary condition of man's health and happiness. Sex inhibitions are viewed as the main source of frustrations, mental and physical illness, and criminality. Sexual chastity is ridiculed as a prudish superstition. Nuptial loyalty is stigmatized as an antiquated hypocrisy. Father is now painted as a jealous tyrant desirous of castrating his sons to prevent incest with their mother. Motherhood is interpreted as a momism, wrecking the lives of children. Sons and daughters are depicted as filled with the complexes of seduction of their mother and their father, respectively. Sexual profligacy and prowess are proudly glamorized. The traditional child of God, created in God's image, is turned into a sexual apparatus, powered by sex instinct, preoccupied with sex matters, aspiring for and dreaming and thinking mainly of sex aspirations and relations. Sexualization of human beings has about reached its saturation point. Our civilization has become so preoccupied with sex that it now oozes from all pores of American life. This man, with the kind of position and money it took to pull it off, traffic that trail as far as you could take it. And this man says, it's futile, it's futility. It's empty. Will every young person hearing these words listen to Solomon and not the words from our times? Will the novice, the inexperienced, the virgin, the person who has not yet walked that journey, will you hear ahead of time the lie of our times and the truth of God? Will you hear it? This man who trafficked in it and lived to tell you about it is going to save you months, years of heartache, if you will only heed what he says. Not some present-day wild-eyed prophet of doom, but the wisest man who ever lived and the richest. In the line of David, appointed by God to script a book that would tell you the truth about sex and about alcohol and about drugs and about the occult and about the supernatural and all of the things you could amass in your fortune, will you listen to him and not your times? If you do not, you are a fool, plain and simple. God does not fill his pages with words to keep us busy reading. He gives us truth to change our lives. He, remember, is not against us. He is for us, child of God. And so since that falls short and begins to leave us with that empty feeling, the man says in verse 2, I'll try laughter. I'll try to make him smile, and I'll turn to my court jesters, and I'll bring on those little people that have the ability to make those funny faces and have those funny one-liners and do those little, it must have been in those ancient days, little sitcoms. And they'll come on with their little plays and their masks and their jokes, and they'll leave us laughing with their comedy routines. They're paid to make us laugh. And so I explored laughter and I explored pleasure. And after all, it feels good to laugh and to have a great time in life. So I'll pursue that. Maybe that holds the secret. Look at verse 2. I said of laughter, madness. I said of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now, the man is not attacking a healthy and necessary sense of humor. We know better than that. The point is, there is no point in it all if your only reason for living is to make people laugh, is to leave them laughing. Who knows how many empty comedians there are in this world who, upon turning in at night, sigh with those same feelings. It's madness. What does it accomplish? I think of the Rodney Dangerfields and the Bill Cosbys and the Steve Martins and the Joan Rivers and the Don Rickles and the Jerry Lewises and the Bob Newharts and the Phyllis Dillers and the whole world of them, and I wonder how many of them really go to bed laughing. There's a motto that Jerry Lewis hangs in his dressing room from sight to sight, and it reads, "There are three things that are real: God, human folly, and laughter. Since the first two are beyond our comprehension, we must do what we can with the third."
With another message based on our study in Ecclesiastes, you're listening to Insight for Living and Chuck Swindoll. He's titled today's sermon, Eat, Drink, and Be What? Download the audio files at insightworld.org. And you'll hear a closing comment from Chuck in just a moment, so please stay with us. There's a growing family of friends who've come alongside Chuck with their consistent prayer support and with monthly automated giving as well. We call them monthly companions. If you value Chuck's teaching and the kind of unfettered honesty that comes through in a series like Living on the Ragged Edge, we invite you to join this family of friends by becoming a monthly companion today. These daily Bible studies are made available in part by the persistent support of our monthly companions. To become a monthly companion, go online to insight.org/monthly companion. Or if you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Well, if you received Chuck's letter this month, then perhaps you've sensed his enthusiasm for Jerry Bridges' excellent book, The Pursuit of Holiness. During this last week in August, this is one of the last times we'll mention this special time-limited offer. Chuck?
In the conversation with Moses, recorded in Leviticus chapter 11, God said, "I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am holy." That's found in Leviticus 11:44 in the New International Version. That's a command from God that should get our complete, undivided attention. Holiness is a serious issue. For starters, what does holiness really look like? And how can broken, sinful people like you and me ever expect to attain any measure of sanctified holiness in these lives of ours? Over 25 years ago, Jerry Bridges wrote a helpful book that has truly stood the test of time. It's now considered a classic. The book is titled The Pursuit of Holiness. In this excellent work, Jerry helps us discern what we should rely upon God to do and what we should accept responsibility for ourselves. You don't come to a position of personal spiritual holiness by accident. We cannot expect to attain any measure of holiness without intentional effort. And for this reason, I strongly recommend your reading this excellent book. Jerry takes holiness out of the realm of the impossible and brings it into the real world of our daily lives. As we used to say, he puts the cookies on the lower shelf. So get yourself a copy today. The Pursuit of Holiness.
And it's yours when you give a donation of any amount. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or online, go to insight.org. Whether you become a monthly companion today or just give a one-time donation of any amount, we'd like to send you this excellent book, The Pursuit of Holiness. It comes with our sincere thanks for your financial support of Insight for Living. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. There's a wealth of free resources available to you on our newly refreshed website. And while you're online, be sure to take advantage of the summer CD sale as well. We're in the final week of the summer CD series sale at insight.org. You'll hear more from Chuck Swindoll's study in Ecclesiastes, Living on the Ragged Edge, Tuesday on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Eat, Drink, and Be What?, was copyrighted in 1983, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2013 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.